got started, I think, a couple decades ago.
Anything you could do would be appreciated.
Yeah, I would love to
listen. The American media system is not that interesting.
It's amazing what they're doing up there. It's a huge area. Isn't it that one Nunavut is like the size of Mexico? I mean, it's a huge province. Okay, we've got to go. Great talking to you all. This is Jacqueline Keeler, and I am a native journalist based here in Portland, Oregon. And you can find me at Jacqueline Keeler on Facebook and at JF Keeler on Twitter. Until next time. Thanks.
Cable Community Radio is hiring a news and public affairs director to manage the evening news and public affairs programming and to train and supervise volunteers. For this full-time position, we're looking for someone with proven experience in news and public affairs production, management and supervisory skills with volunteers with an emphasis on teamwork in a collaborative setting, and ability to work under strict deadlines. Cable Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. People of color and women are encouraged to apply. The deadline to apply is Monday, July 1st at midnight. More information can be found at kbu.fm/employment.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9 o'clock. Coming up next on Radio Zine, Suzanne LeGrand interviews Chris Wilson, author of The Master Plan, My Journey from Life in Prison to Life of Purpose. At 9:30, the Women's International News Gathering Service travels to the Arizona-Mexico border to take a look into what asylum seekers are fleeing from and what they face on their trip north. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and at 11, the Dirtbag takes on raspberries. Hot weather gardening, planting for fall and winter, and the Fig Evaluation Project. Don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.fm, on iTunes and Google Play. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to KBOO.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
My name is Suzanne LeGrand, and I am here with Chris Wilson, who is the author of The Master Plan, My Journey from Prison to a Life of Purpose. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I don't know if anyone else has done what you did, which is to go from a life prison sentence to talking a judge into reducing your prison sentence and getting out.
But before we get to that story, let's start with where you grew up and how that played a role in how you ended up in prison.
I grew up in Washington, D.C., Northeast, around, I guess, late 80s, early 90s was the time I was there. And it was pretty segregated, just like, you know, all black people, like, in my neighborhood. Very, very violent, a lot of drugs. This was around the time when the crack epidemic was sweeping through our communities. And so it was a lot of gun violence, unfortunately, in our neighborhood. So it was a pretty tough time.
A lot of people talk about how young people of color, particularly African-American men and women, are kind of tracked towards prison. Do you think that's true?
I don't think people of color are like tracked towards prison, but I do believe that there has been a racist system and policies put in place that was designed to prey on people of color and make things. So if you can look at like redlining, denying people like access to loans to buy their homes, setting up policies where, you know, you militarizing your police force and giving them quotas so they gotta lock people up, and you're taking people's right to vote, and like all of these things, when you add them all up, it excommunicates the communities of people of color and doesn't allow them to participate. And so as a result, like, they don't, you know, they can't move up mm-hmm. in America, and they suffer from it, and they ended up going to prison. And like the prison system, like slavery never went away. Like, it just metamorphosized itself into something different. It went from like slavery to Jim Crow and like all these different types of policies, the crime bill. And it's just a way to oppress communities of color, in my opinion.
Can you talk a little bit about the educational system that you experienced when you were growing up? Did that play a role in how?
So that was a critical role in my life. And even when I was in like elementary school, my teachers, it would be like shootings outside of the school, but our teachers would have us in that classroom even when stuff was going on outside, and they would stress to us the importance of education, and they would tell us, like, you know, the system may want to lock you up and people might want to like take stuff from you, but no one can take knowledge from you. Like, if you learn and you like study and educate yourself, then you can be successful in life. And so that was something that I remembered from a child, and when I eventually like went to prison, that was like something that I truly embraced, because I knew I was always book smart. I could read really well, even as a young kid when I was like 8. Like, I was reading above my level, but I never applied myself because my friends would tell me, like, man, that's lame. You want to read books all day. And I didn't play sports, and so they would tease me. I think, unfortunately, like, there were so many things that were stacked against me growing up in my community. Like, I love school. Like, I used to win awards for, like, not missing a day for the entire school year for attendance. So I loved it. But there's so much stuff that went on, like, leaving school and or even trying to get to school and go home from school, that those things overcame, like, the power of education.
Can you speak a little bit about that? Like, what was hard about getting to school?
So with so much gun violence in my neighborhood, and as a young kid, I would have to try to plan my routes just to get to school. I would walk to school, and it would be shootings, it would be dead bodies, and I try to have to figure that out. But the deeper impact of that is the trauma that I experienced from all the stuff that I saw. Like, I would have to go to school and be like a shooter, and I'll see like a young girl get shot by a stray bullet, and she would die, and we would watch her die. Like, the police wouldn't come because it was a tough neighborhood. It'd take them like 35 minutes to get there. And then I would have to go to school, and my teachers would, you know, try to explain work to me, but I couldn't concentrate. All I would think about was what I just saw, or I couldn't sleep at night. And a lot of young people who witness stuff like this in the communities, they experience it, and it's hard for them to learn in school or focus because, like, we don't understand what we saw. Like, it's trauma.
Do you think this is a common experience, this kind of trauma?
Absolutely, it's a common experience. I went to a school 2 days ago here in Baltimore City, and it's a very, very tough neighborhood. The entire high school was surrounded by vacant houses. And this young guy, I spoke to the kids, and I was talking about the book, and this young guy didn't speak during the whole time. And afterwards, he pulled me up, and he was like, I don't want to talk in front of everybody. And he started telling me, he was like, you know, my dad, you know, disowned me and my brother. My mom is bipolar. Like, I watched several of my friends get killed, and my mom's thinking about killing herself. She's been talking about it. And, like, I just feel alone. He was shaking while he was talking to me. And I felt like I was talking to my younger self. And this happens often, like several times a week. And so we gotta do something to address this issue that happens in these communities, especially with our young people.
What do you think could be done? I mean, do you have a sense of how the educational system could respond differently or help these kids?
Yes, I do, actually. I think so. A couple of things. Like, one, I think teachers should be educated. And most of them are, though, but like, they should be educated and provided with resources to help our young people who experience this trauma. So like, when I was growing up, somebody get killed or something happens on the school grounds or something, and they just like get back to work. And it's like, these experiences, kids' brains aren't developed, so they can't process what they just saw, what they just experienced. And so we should be providing therapy for our young people who experience like traumatic experiences. And just talk and allow them to talk about and ask questions about like what they saw, because like a lot of stuff that happened when I was young that I saw, I just didn't understand. I used to ask my grandmother, grandma, like, who we at war with? Like, why is there so much shooting? Like I thought, like, you know, the war was over in America, man. And so we gotta do more things that is proactive towards our young people.
In your book, you talked about a lot of gun violence when you were growing up, but you also talked about domestic violence. And in fact, you noted that was kind of the point in your life where things really went downhill when your mother got involved with the wrong man, as you put it.
Right. Yes. I mean, for me, and I think I could speak for most young people, like your mother is like the person that, like, that's how you learn about love, unconditional love. Like, you know, I love my mom more than anyone in this world. And to watch someone, and she was a nice person, she was smart, she was ambitious, and to watch like someone, especially even me as a police officer, just watch him like beat my mom and like talk down to her and stuff like that, it was painful. And I didn't understand it, and I felt helpless. And that was something that just made me an angry young man. Growing up, I just was angry about that, and I would take it out on other people.
So let's talk a little bit about your time in prison. How did you end up there?
So after my mom and I were attacked by this police officer, and he knocked me unconscious. And when I woke up, he was raping my mom, and he tried to kill her. But she survived. We both survived. And after that, I started carrying a gun because he got a little bit of time. He got out and he started stalking our family. And so we all started carrying guns, even my sister. My brother got shot a couple times. He survived. My cousin got shot 17 times. He passed away. A few months after that, I was just by my house and some men started following me. And I went to a space where there was a lot of people, like a gas station, a 7-Eleven. I was like, they probably won't bother me here. I had a gun on me, though, but I just didn't want to use it. And they came after me, and one guy tried to get behind me, and they were threatening me, saying they knew where I live at, my family, and they were going to kill us. And I fired my weapon at one of the guys who was trying to get behind me, and they ran away. And I found out a few weeks later that I took a person's life, and I was charged as an adult and sentenced to natural life in prison.
Why were you charged as an adult when you were 17?
Well, after the 94 crime bill that was put in place in this country, they just felt like, you know, what do they call it, super predators, and that, you know, we need to be locked away. And it was like this, you know, tough on crime approach. And even if you was a child, like they would treat you as an adult because they felt like our lives wasn't redeemable.
So can you talk a little bit about what life was like in prison when you went there? You went there into an adult prison at 17 years old with a life sentence.
Yes. Right. I mean, it was the equivalence of being teleported to another planet. Different rules. Like, it's very, very strange. And again, like, I was a child. I was small. I went to prison. I think I was like 120 pounds. Didn't have a mustache. And it was crazy. It was a nightmare. And I was terrified. I was like, I don't know how I'm going to survive in here. And, I fell into a depression for my first year.
Do you think that the other prisoners were like you, that they had been through some major traumas?
Yes. So for my first 2 years in prison, I wouldn't talk in therapy because I felt like no one would be able to relate to my story. And eventually when I opened up in therapy, other people started opening up, and I realized we all were going through like the same stuff. Moms getting beaten up in front of them, gun violence and trauma and fighting. And so I think it was healthy. Like, it's painful, it's hard to do, but I believe it's a sign of strength to open up and talk about these issues in prison. And then something clicked. Like, I met a person, a guy, Steven, who also had a life sentence, who was studying software. And he had these dreams that he would get out one day and he was going to be successful. And I was motivated. And so I decided to go to my cell and write up kind of like a bucket list, but I call it my master plan of things that I wanted to do. But the most important thing is I wanted to prove to myself and to everyone else that I was intelligent, that I was a good person, and that I could be free one day. And I wanted to give back to people. And so that was like the genesis of creating the master plan.
What was it that made you decide that you were going to have a different future?
So it was a couple things. Like, first, like, I'm a stubborn person. And so I think I like applied my stubbornness in a positive way, though. In the book, I call it a positive delusion, where you believe that it's going to happen. But the other thing is, I was motivated by my friend, and I've always been a dreamer, and I used to dream about just like being able to travel, like do stuff. And I just chose to believe that my life, I wasn't put here in this world to spend the rest of my life in prison. Because, like, you know, it's unfortunate. I did take a person's life, but I didn't start it. I didn't come after these people. I didn't want to do it. And so it happened, and I was like, how can my life be over? And it was like, and then I was looking around, I was seeing so many people who looked like me who were just stuck in prison and going through all this stuff. And I decided, it was like, you know, I'm going to figure out a way how I can get out of prison and be a positive example to people. I want to break this cycle. And that's how it all started right there. And it was a leap of faith.
And so how did you do it?
So the main thing that I focused on was education. I could, like, so for example, I could pick up a 300-page book, and I can read this book in like a day and a half or 2 days top, and I could remember everything that I read, right? So I was like, all right, well, how about I figure out what I want to do in my life? What's my end game? Who do I want to be when I'm, let's say, 40 years old? And then I'll work backwards towards that. And so I was like, okay, I made up a list of things that I need to do. I was like, all right, I'm going to get my high school diploma. Like, my parents and family members will always get on me about it. So I started studying, got my high school diploma in 2 months. I said, okay, what else we have? Vocational shops, carpentry, plumbing. And it's a 2-year program. I did it in 13 months. So I was like, well, and it started building up my confidence. And I was like, well, maybe I am intelligent. So I started studying foreign languages and reading books. And then the college program came, and then I got into college. And that's when I was just like, it really opened my mind to how big the world was and like what was possible. And thankfully, even after I got my college degree, they allowed me to continue to study. It was like, I was like a special project. They would just like give me books to read and like, you know, do research on the internet and just really like push me. And then throughout that whole time, I was going to therapy and I started opening up and started really digging into like my issues as a person.
Could you talk a little bit about how education opened you up, as you said?
Yeah, so a couple things. Like, I remember like taking history classes and just reading about people who, like, and it was a different era, obviously, like back in the day, hundreds of years, but people just like doing like amazing things, building cities and stuff. And I started reading about the civil rights movement, and I felt bad. And I would look around, all I would see is black people in prison. And I was like, man, like, folks like would do sit-ins, they would get dressed, children would get locked up, people would have food poured on their head, all that just for like equal rights, civil rights. Right. And I was like, so I felt bad, and I felt moved to like prove that or pick up the torch and finish the fight. And then I started mentoring other people, and I would see the change in people. You know, I would mentor a guy with like 40 years. He'd get into college, he'd get into therapy and like do all the stuff. And like in a few years, he'll go back to court and get his sentence reduced. And then he'll go home, start his own business, start a family and stuff and stay out of prison. And I would do that like often. And so I realized like that was like the magic sauce.
Are these typical experiences? I mean, do most people who are in prison have access to high school education, vocational education, college education?
Our college program at the prison I was in was something that was funded for the federal Pell Grant, where some federal money trickled down on the state level, and they kind of just experimented with us. And I think it was like 150 of us that ended up getting into this college program. But everyone who got into the program ended up going home and became successful, and none of them went back. And there's data all over the place that supports that even a little bit of like college education reduces the recidivism rate. So I'm an advocate for like having college in every prison, because it keeps people from going back to prison.
A lot of people in this country have this attitude that if somebody has committed a crime, they should be punished, and they should be punished harshly. And they associate that with justice. What do you think about that mentality? Is that a way for people to learn from their mistakes?
So I don't agree with that completely, right? But that being said, if you do commit a crime, I feel like you should be punished, right? That's fair, right? That's a part of justice, right? But I think, at least in America, we put too much emphasis on the punishment aspect, and especially victims, right? Like the victims, at least in my experience in the Black community, the victims eventually become the victimizers, right? So we gotta start supporting my victims who experience crimes and providing therapy for them. But that being said, if you commit a crime, yeah, you should be punished, and like not for the rest of your life, not 30 years for a $20 bag of drugs, right? So I think we shouldn't do that. But what we should do is focus on, if we call it in the correctional facility, if someone has to go to prison and taxpayers are paying for it, then we want that person to get some help when they're behind the fence. Like if someone breaks into your car and like steals your radio, you don't want them to go back to prison. You want them to be punished, but you don't want them to sit in prison and learn how to be a better thief, and they get out and they're just like, you know what, I can disarm your alarm system in your house, and they come break into your house. Like, you want them to get help, because we're paying for it anyway. So we want them to come out and say, you know what, instead of breaking into cars, I learned how to fix cars and repair them, you know, sell cars or whatever, instead of like breaking into them. And so that's what I see prisons should be. It should be success factories.
And are they right now?
They're not. There are like a small percentage of people who take it upon themselves to teach themselves or take advantage of the programs that's in there, and they get out and they're successful. But as a society, we should want everyone to go into prison and say, like, all right, you messed up, and you losing your freedom is your punishment, but while you're here, use this time to better yourself so you can get out and not hurt anybody else, and live a successful life, live a beautiful life.
Let's talk a little bit about how you ended up getting out of prison, even though you had a life sentence. Could you tell that story?
Yes. So while I was embarking on my educational pursuits, I was every time I would accomplish stuff and like therapy sessions and graduate from vocational shop, I would reach back out to the courts and I would be denied, because the political climate in the state of Maryland, when you get sentenced to a life sentence, you usually grow old and you die there. And so I was frustrated, but like at a point of like 10 and a half years in prison and being denied five times, I was mentoring this young guy one day, and he was like, you know, I don't understand why you can't get out. And he was like, I see all these people get out of prison, and then they come back, and then they get out, and you stuck in here, and you helped all of us, but like, you can't get a shot. And he was like, you know, I don't want to get too religious with you, but maybe, he said, I never hear you talk about God, so maybe that's what's missing from your life. And at the time, you know, I believed in God, I just didn't understand God. And so I literally like just went to my cell and just started praying for a sign from God. And I used to ask God, I was like, you know, just show me that what I'm doing right now, that I'm on like the right track, and that I could get out. And I ended up getting a court date.
And what happened at the court date?
I mean, at the court date, I had an opportunity to apologize to the courts for like the crime that I committed. I also had an opportunity to talk about all the things that I've been through in my community as a young man, and just being angry and just trying to convey the experiences. And I talked about all my educational accomplishments and what I would do if given a second chance, that I would commit my life to being successful, to giving back, to volunteering, and just like doing the right thing. And I know it was like a stretch, but they took a gamble on me and they gave me my second chance. So I've just been trying to pay it forward ever since.
So you had a life sentence, but you ended up getting a reduced sentence and you got out after 16 years.
Yes.
And when you got out, a lot of people who are ex-felons encounter incredible barriers to starting a new life. Was that also true for you?
Yeah. I mean, it was scary. It was tough. But I was lucky. I mean, it took me 52 days to find a job. But there were all kinds of barriers, especially having to check in like twice a week with the probation officer once out of prison. And it's like, how do you maintain a job when you gotta leave work twice a week, like to take a urinalysis, and then you gotta pay for the urinalysis, and you're like not even making money yet? But the biggest barrier for me, or I think for most people, is the psychological aspect of, you know, being in prison for so long and getting out and just, like, not having anything. Like, I didn't have a car. I didn't have, like, I had a $10 phone from Radio Shack, and I was 32 years old. And I would see people my age, and they have, like, families, houses, cars and stuff. And, like, that messes with you psychologically. And so most people, they revert back to, like, what they knew before they went in, because they want to move fast. They want to get their lives back together, or they have responsibilities to take care of their children. So it's tough.
You were required to check in twice a week during work hours and pay? How much did you pay?
Yeah. Like $40 per your analysis.
So you had to pay $80 a week for this?
Okay. Yeah, so the way it works was, when you first get out, like, you got to check in for, like, the first month or two twice a week, and then, like, the third month is once a week. And then, like, the fourth month, if you do okay, then it's, like, once a month. But, like, you pay for that. And even being out, like, you got to pay restitution. Like, I had, like, several thousand dollars of restitution to pay. And everyone has to pay it. And then, like, when you can't pay it, you know, that goes on your record. Like, you could be, like, violated on your parole and probation just for, like, not being able to do it. And it's just a lot of pressure.
So you have all of these bills that you immediately have to pay upon getting out, but you don't have access to getting a job. And if you don't pay them, you can end up back in jail. Is that right?
Absolutely. Which is, I mean, it's suspicious, right? You think about it, it's like, well, like, the deck is already stacked against them. Like, why is it so, like, tough? I used to ask sometimes my parole officer, like, where does this money go to? Like, what's the money for? Does it? Well, I mean, like, if it goes to the victim's family or something like that, then, like, I could understand it, but it doesn't. And it was like, it goes to us. And I was like, well, what do y'all need money for? You're already getting paid. And it's just like, we just need it. But, like, so it's a mechanism to get people back in prison. Like, it has been turned into a business now. Like, people got to keep beds filled.
Can you talk a little bit about that? You know, I read someplace that it costs more to keep somebody in prison per year than it does to send them to Harvard.
Right, absolutely. So the way it works, right? And so you have these people in prison, right, unfortunately, and then there's all these private prisons and private companies that provide services and stuff to these prisons, like commissary, like, you know, coffee and stuff, phone calls and everything at, like, these crazy, like, rates that, you know, super expensive. For example, like, when I was in prison, the average person makes $25 a month. It's $10 for a 30-minute phone call, right? So, like, that's predatory. And so all these things happen, and what they do is they give the prisoners a kickback on all the money that they make every month, right? And then they lobby, right? They lobby politicians, and they give them money to keep, like, these policies in place. And politicians have put all kinds of stuff in place, like, you know, prisoners make furniture, they make license plates, and stuff that goes on signs for cars and businesses. And then on the state level, they'll pass legislation that says you got to do business with these prison companies. Like, you got to make them a priority. And so it's just like how the prison system was back in the day with, like, slavery and Jim Crow. Convict lease system, I think was what it was called. Folks who are in power, they want to stay in power. And so this is a way, like, to suppress and oppress, you know, people, especially people of color. Like, this stuff was put in place deliberately.
So having gone through all of these experiences and being a strong advocate for helping people who have gone through the criminal justice or maybe injustice system, what would you say needs to change?
So I think instead of this get tough on crime approach to prison, we should think about, we should make prison rehabilitation centers. And so we should put more focus on education. We should also get rid of these mandatory sentencing laws and allow more discretion for our prosecutors and judges to look at individuals who commit crimes by case by case. We shouldn't turn prison into a business. I think therapy needs to be provided in prison too. A lot of people, unfortunately, in prison have experienced so many traumatic situations, and we got to address those. Like, we got to treat people and address their mental health issues to allow them to reacclimate back to society. Especially like young people who like commit crimes, like, we shouldn't throw them away. Their lives are redeemable, and we should give people opportunities. Like, if we got to get punished and people are working really hard behind the fence, they should be allowed to come home and reacclimate to society. Like, we shouldn't be cruel. Like, that shouldn't be like what America stands for. We shouldn't be cruel. We shouldn't be like so reactive to stuff that happens. Let's be proactive. Let's learn to forgive people and let people like live. And I think like the world would be different. America would be different if we operated that way.
I have been speaking today with Chris Wilson, author of The Master Plan, My Journey from Life in Prison to a Life of Purpose. For more about his work, you can go to chriswilson.biz. I'm Suzanne LeGrand, and this is KBOO Portland.
Sponsor of the 50th anniversary of Oxamoxwa with the Garcia Birthday Band on Friday, June 14th at 8 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. Oxamoxwa is a 1969 album by the Grateful Dead. Fans and critics alike consider this era to be the band's experimental apex. The Garcia Birthday Band is a group of veteran musicians interpreting and celebrating the repertoire of the late Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead. Again, that's the 50th anniversary of Oxamoxwa with the Garcia Birthday Band on Friday, June 14th at 8 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Coming up next, the Women's International News Gathering Service travels to the Arizona-Mexico border to take a look at